after our excursion into the clouds of category theory, we'll be on much more solid ground today again and do something very concrete. Remember, we defined directional derivatives at the very beginning. We identified the directional derivatives with tangent vectors. So what can we directionally differentiate now? Well, we can directionally differentiate functions on the manifold. Give me a function f, and then I apply a tangent vector to it, and that the output is again a function, and at every point it means the directional derivative of that function in the direction of that tangent vector or tangent vector field. So in particular, a tangent vector field maps functions into functions. The image is a function, which at every point is a directional derivative of the previous function in the direction which we want, in which the vector field is pointing. But we would like to be able to differentiate directionally anything, not just functions, but also tensors of any kind and of differential forms, those anti-symmetric, completely anti-symmetric covariant tensors. So today we'll do the directional derivatives for differential forms and then generalize that to the directional derivatives for any kind of tensor. Let me start with a quick review of differential forms. The set of differential forms on the manifold is an associative algebra called the Grassmann algebra. The multiplication in this Grassmann algebra is the wedge product. You take an S form and an R form. The wedge product of the two of them is an S plus R form. We defined already one kind of derivative, namely the exterior derivative. It maps differential forms into differential forms. It is an antiderivation of degree k equal 1. Degree k equal 1 meant that the degree of the differential form goes up by 1. Yes?
In the Grassmann algebra, when we add a 1 form to a 2 form, how do we think of that as a map? Because a 1 form is a map from vectors to numbers, and a 2 form is a map from 2.
Yeah, you shouldn't think of it as a map in that sense. You wouldn't do that with just regular tensors, you wouldn't do that. But with the Grassmann algebra, we define it to be that. It's just a linear combination of them.
So we don't think of it as a map.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a bit like, let's say, in quantum field theory, you could imagine, or in quantum theory in general, you could have that, even in quantum field theory, you could assume a situation where a quantum field might be in a state where it's in a particular state. So it's it takes a particular wave form, but it might also be in a state where it takes a particular different shape. So the E field, the electric field, might be a particular electric field or another particular electric field. These would be pure states in the theory. And you can have a linear combination of the two of them. And then you can no longer think of them as being a map of position into amplitude, because that, right? And so here now, this has nothing to do with quantum, of course. But it's true that the moment you form that linear combination, it's a linear combination of objects that have that interpretation, but the sum of them doesn't have that. That's right. But it will turn out to be a very powerful construction. So the multiplication in the Grassmann algebra is the wedge product. The exterior derivative we defined is an antiderivation of degree k equal 1. And k equal plus 1 means that the degree goes up. D maps 1 forms into 2 forms, 0 forms into 1 forms, m forms into m plus 1 forms. It's an antiderivation because there could be a minus sign when you do when you use the Leibniz rule, depending on the degree of the differential forms that you are taking the derivation of. But the exterior derivative wasn't a directional derivative. It gave us some kind of derivative, a derivation, but There was no way that we could specify a direction. You just take a differential form, you apply the D to it, you get its derivation, but it's not a derivation in any particular direction. So how do we obtain a directional derivative on differential forms? Well, let's remember that tangent vectors are directional derivatives on zero forms. So we already have directional derivatives on zero forms. But if you remember, zero forms are simply scalars, scalar functions. And tangent vectors are directional derivatives on scalar functions. That means we can pursue now the following strategy. If you remember derivations, I'll mention that later. So our plan now is that we define an antiderivation, the so-called inner derivation, I index xi, which will be an antiderivation, again, so there could be minus signs, of degree k equal to minus 1. And then we will combine the exterior and the inner derivation to obtain a derivation of degree k equals 0. Why would we want a derivation of degree k equals 0? Well, it's because the tangent vectors already perform a task of that kind. The tangent vectors map lambda 0 into lambda 0. They map functions, into their directional derivative. So the tangent vectors are directional derivatives which preserve the degree of the differential form where they act, which is the zero forms. So what we are after is a generalization of the directional derivative that applies not just to zero forms, but to n forms. But it's natural that we don't reinvent the wheel for zero forms, but we take what we already have. Our general definition of the directional derivative should be this for zero forms. And there, k is equal to 0. We're not changing zero forms to one forms or something like that. The exterior derivation was a plus 1 form, plus 1 derivation, k equal plus 1 derivation. So if we now take another derivation, which has a k equal to minus 1, maybe if we combine them, like apply one after the other, then we could get a k equals 0 derivation that could be the directional derivative. You see, if we apply first d, it turns an r form into an r plus 1 form. But if we then apply the inner derivation after that, it could lead it back. It will map an r plus 1 form into an r form so that the concatenation of the two has a chance of being a k equals 0 form. It's not guaranteed that the concatenation of two derivations gives you a derivation. And it won't. It will be a little bit more complicated than that. But that's the overall idea. Directional derivatives shouldn't change the degree of the thing that you're differentiating. The name that we will give to the directional derivative that can act on all differential forms and later on all tensors will be the Lie derivative. Okay, so the key ingredient for that is going to be the inner derivation. Let's define that thing. Assume that xi is a tangent vector field. That's the vector field that we will use to specify in which direction we want to differentiate. At every point in the manifold, we pick a direction given by the tangent vector field xi. Now, we want to define an antiderivation I, which uses that xi, to obtain an... we want to define an antiderivation of degree k equal minus 1 that uses this xi. And if you remember, a derivation can be specified by specifying what it does on the zero forms and what it does on a basis of the one forms. And then just by linearity and the Leibniz rule, we can already deduce what it does on all forms. So we want to construct an antiderivation of degree k equal minus 1. So an antiderivation that maps S forms into S minus forms. And we define it, we will call it that it, The notation is that you will map a differential S form into I, index xi of omega, which will be a differential S minus 1 form. And it is supposed to obey the Leibniz rule. Here it is. It needs to obey that if we apply the derivation on the wedge product of two differential forms, then we should get its application on the first one, leaving the second the same, plus leaving the first one the same and then applying the derivation on the second factor with this minus sign, which is there or not there, depending on the degree of the first of the two differential forms, r. So that's the degree of omega. Now we use the fact that if we define a derivation on zero forms and the basis of one forms, then we are done. We have it defined everywhere. We define the inner derivation to map all of the functions to zero. And we define it to map the one forms into functions, as it should, because it's supposed to be a k minus one derivation, a derivation with a k of equal to minus one. And how do we do that? Well, as input to the inner derivation, we take some differential one form, and then the number that we should get out of it, or the function that we get out of it, is obtained by applying that one form onto the vector field that specifies the direction in which we want to differentiate. So this thing is really just the evaluation of a covector on a vector, where the vector is the direction in which we want to differentiate, and the covector is the field that is being differentiated, is the contravariant vector field that's being differentiated. It's really just like the inner product of vector spaces, which is why it's called the inner derivation. You shouldn't think of it as a derivation in the sense of taking a limit like a Newton-Leibniz or so. It's an algebraic thing, which is important because we want to apply this together with the exterior derivative to obtain a directional derivative. But the exterior derivative is a first derivative. The directional derivative should also be first derivative. If this derivation included any actual derivative taking, we would end up with a second derivative, but that's not what we want. We want the lead derivative, the directional derivative, did I mention that we want to call these things lead derivative, right? Here, the thing that we eventually want to get, the directional derivative, we will call the lead derivative. So we want the lead derivative to be a first derivative, as directional derivatives always are. So it's important and useful that this doesn't involve any derivative taking in the Newton-Leibniz sense. So it's really a very simple operation. It simply plugs the direction vector xi into the one form to give you a number at every point, so a function. But now we've already defined the inner derivation everywhere, because we've defined how it acts on functions, on zero forms. We've defined how it acts on one forms, and therefore we can now calculate how it acts on any arbitrary form, simply because any arbitrary form is the wedge product of one forms and zero forms, and we already know how it acts on one forms and zero forms, and we know the Leibniz rule, so we know how to handle wedge products. So we have already defined via the anti-Leibniz rule what the inner derivation does for any differential form. Let's see what it does. Let's say that gamma is an S form, it's a differential S form. Then the inner derivation of that differential S form is a differential S minus 1 form. And being a differential S minus 1 form, it is in particular an S minus 1, it is in particular something that takes as input S minus 1 tangent vectors and gives you as output a number or a function if you look at it globally. So let us say we use as the input vectors, input tangent vectors, s minus 1, we use the vectors eta 1 to eta s minus 1, arbitrary vectors. It turns out that because of the way we defined the inner derivation, we can conclude by applying the Leibniz rule that the action of the inner derivation on this arbitrary S form is such that the number that is produced by the S minus 1 form when acting on S minus 1 arbitrary tangent vectors is the number that you get when you take the full S form that you started out with before you differentiated it with the inner derivation and feed it the direction vector xi in here and all the other S minus 1 tangent vectors. In other words, it turns out that the inner derivation is simply the procedure of plugging in the xi as the first argument in a differential form. So you have a differential S form, and by differentiating it, by taking the inner derivation in the xi direction, you're simply plugging the xi as the first argument into that differential form. Right? So you take the original differential S form, plug in the first as the first argument the direction in which you want to differentiate, and then s minus 1 other tangent vectors. That number is the number you get if you take the inner derivation of gamma, which now only feeds on s minus 1 tangent vectors, and that turns out to be this. For example, let's just see how that works. Let's say we consider a differential 2 form, which is the wedge product of a 1 form and a 1 form. Remember, not all differential 2 forms are of that kind, right? You can have a linear combination of several of these. Anyway, let's say that gamma is the wedge product of 2 1 forms. Then what is the inner derivation of gamma in the direction of a tangent vector xi? We know it's going to be a 1 form. But what is it? So we take the inner derivation of the 2 form gamma, and we can write this as the inner derivation of its constituents here, omega and nu, by the anti-Leibniz rule. This is the inner derivation acting on the first argument, leaving the second alone, minus, because we're dealing with 1 forms, so this is a minus 1 to the power 1, so minus, leaving the first differential form the same and taking the inner derivation of the second one. Now, we do know what that is, because this is the application of the inner derivation in the direction of xi on a cotangent vector, on a 1 form. And if you remember, we defined this to be omega of xi. And similarly here, we already defined how the inner derivation acts on 1 forms. Remember, that's how we set it up. We defined how it acts on 0 forms by mapping all of them to 0. And we defined how it acts on 1 forms, namely by simply evaluating. So what we get is that this number is that number. So now let's take the inner derivation of gamma, which is a 1 form, and apply it to a tangent vector eta. What do we get? So we have the inner derivation of gamma, which is this, where that is a number at every point of the manifold. That's a number, that's a number, that's a 1 form, that's a 1 form. So the whole thing is a 1 form, as it should be, because it's of degree minus 1. So we apply now this, which is to say that, on a tangent vector. So we take this expression here and feed it a tangent vector eta. Now that is carried forward from here to here because it's just a number. That's a 1 form which is being fed a tangent vector, which is then nu of eta, which is a number again. We carry that number forward here, and now we have to feed this omega, that tangent vector, we get that. Now let's compare that with the claim of the proposition, which was that the inner derivation of gamma applied to a tangent vector, so the inner derivation of omega veg nu applied to a tangent vector, is what you get when you plug in the first argument. So when you plug psi in as the first argument. Now the veg product of two differential one forms, if you remember, is omega tensor nu minus nu tensor omega. If you just have a one form and a one form, it's very easy to anti-symmetrize that. And that's, of course, what the anti-symmetric tensor product is. So we need to take the inner derivation of this and apply it to eta. And sorry, I'm a little confused at the moment. Let's just go back to the proposition. Okay, so the proposition was that when you take the inner derivation and interdirection of psi and feed it these tangent vectors, in our case it's going to be just one tangent vector here, then this is equal to what you get when you take the original two form in our case and you plug these two arguments in there, first argument, second argument. All right, so that's what the claim is, and that's what we get, and if you compare that with here, it's the same thing. Now, we will need to collect some properties of our derivations, the inner derivation and the exterior derivation, also for later reference, because they come up quite a bit. So the inner derivation has the property that it is anti-symmetric under concatenation. So if you apply the inner derivation in one direction, then inner derivation in another direction, it's the same as if you did it the other way around, but with a minus sign. And why is that? Well, you see, the inner derivation means you plug in the vector psi as the first argument of a differential form. If you do it again, then you plug it into what is now the first argument of the differential form, which is the second argument. If you do it the other way around, you get the same thing, except that what used to be in the first slot is now in the second, and vice versa. If you can flip that around, but differential forms are anti-symmetric, that's why you get the minus sign. And what this also means is that if you want to do the inner derivation twice in the same direction, then you get zero, because then you have that the left-hand side is equal to minus the right-hand side, which is neat. Because also the d squared was zero. Completely different reasons, but both of them have that property. It's also called a boundary property, because boundaries don't have boundaries. Now, when psi is a tangent vector at a point, and gamma is a cotangent vector at a point, then the inner derivation of gamma in the direction of psi is, and that was was part of the definition of the inner derivation, just the evaluation of the gamma on the psi, which is the evaluation of the psi on the gamma. You know, tangent and cotangent vectors are dual to each other. Just wondering what. Yeah, it's just saying that they're dual vectors to each other. So therefore, the inner derivation of gamma in the direction of psi is also can also be called the interior product of psi and gamma. It's just the evaluation of a tangent vector against a cotangent vector, or a cotangent vector evaluated against a tangent vector. That's what the inner derivation does for one forms. Now we're ready. Now that we have the exterior derivative and the inner derivation, we can define the Lie derivation or Lie derivative. It will be denoted by L, And the direction in which we want to differentiate is xi. We want it to be the usual derivative for functions, usual directional derivative for functions, so basically xi. And it should, however, generalize nicely. We will start with the algebraic definition of the Lie derivative as a derivation, but that will only work for differential forms. And then we'll have to rethink and redefine the whole thing to generalize it for arbitrary tensors. So remember, the tangent vectors are directional derivatives for functions. They map functions, into the directional derivatives in the direction xi. How then can we generalize this idea to obtain directional derivatives of any differential form? Well, what are the ingredients that we have? We have that the exterior derivative is mapping s plus into s plus 1 forms, and it generalizes the notion of differential. Remember, the differential that we had in the very first lecture was, or maybe the second, it was mapping functions into 1 forms. For every f, you get a df. Right? F is a function, df is a differential 1 form. And we generalize the notion of differential d to obtain the exterior derivative by generalizing that. You see k is equal to plus 1 here, it raises the degree, by generalizing this to all of the Grassmann algebra. Also, the inner derivation is generalizing something that we had before. Just like the exterior derivative is generalizing the notion of differential to all of the Grassmann algebra, the inner derivation is generalizing the notion of evaluating a tangent vector against a cotangent vector to all of the Grassmann algebra. Namely, instead of feeding a tangent vector into a cotangent vector to get a number, the inner derivation generally takes an arbitrary differential form and feeds it the tangent vector as the first argument. If the differential form is a 1 form, it's just the evaluation of cotangent vector over tangent vector. But it's just generalizing this by saying that take your differential form, make the feed the first argument, the xi. We could have defined it right away like that, but then we wouldn't have known it's an antiderivation of degree minus 1 and so on. So this generalizes the notion of evaluation of vectors on covectors to all of the Grassmann algebra. And let me tell you right away what we're going to end up with. We're going to define the Lie derivation as the anti-commutator of the exterior and the inner derivation. Remember, we already discussed that since d is raising the degree of a differential form by 1 and I is decreasing it, the concatenation of the two will leave it the same. So whether or not that's a derivation, we don't know yet. But it's definitely going to be of k equals 0. And the same with this. It lowers the degree and then raises it again. So to construct the Lie derivation, let's see what desired properties we want it to have. It should be a directional derivation. So it should be a derivation and not an antiderivation. A directional derivation should be intuitive, no extra minus signs. So we want it to act on differential forms in such a way that we have the usual Leibniz rule, no chance of minus signs there. The directional derivative in the direction of xi of that should be the Lie derivative on the first factor, leaving the second the same, and vice versa. Okay, so we want a derivation, not an antiderivation. Also, it should map R forms into R forms, because the directional derivative on functions has that property. It maps functions into functions, so it doesn't change the degree of the zero forms, so the generalization to all arbitrary differential forms should also respect the degree of the form. So we want our Lie derivative to map R forms into R forms. should be of degree k equals 0. And on functions, it should be the usual directional derivative. So the directional derivative of a function is a function, and the directional derivative of a function in the direction of xi should be the directional derivative of the function f in the direction of xi, which is, you know, that's how we define the xi. So the Lie derivative on zero forms, the Lie derivative on functions should be just the action of that tangent vector on the function. That's what that is. We already have done with defining the Lie derivative, because if you remember, any derivation is already specified completely if we specify how it acts on zero forms and how it acts on a basis of one form. Because then we can already derive how it acts on all differential forms just by using linearity and the product rule. That is to say, the Leibniz rule. So we've already defined how our Lie derivative acts on functions. Now we just need to define how it acts on one forms. So let's consider, therefore, some one forms. Let's say f's are arbitrary functions, then df is always a one form. And let us choose, for example, the df to be the dxi. So the df is, if you remember, the gradient field of f. If f is a function, then df is a one form. And in electromagnetism, you would have called that the gradient field. Or like if f was the potential, df would be the electric field, the gradient. So now the idea, okay, so remember what challenge we now have. We know how the Lie derivative acts on zero forms. Apply the vector field to the function. But how should the directional derivative work for one forms? Well, if we can figure out how it works for the one forms which form a basis, namely these dxi, then we are already set. If we can only define how the Lie derivative acts on the dxi, then we have the Lie derivative on a basis of the tangent space, and then we have generated everything. But how should the Lie derivative act on those coordinate functions? Well, here it is natural to make this definition. We define the directional derivative of a gradient field, and remember the df are gradient fields, the dxi are gradient fields, and that's just the name that they have. The d of any zero form is a gradient field. We define that the directional derivative of a gradient field, that is to say of a df, is the gradient of the directional derivative of the field, or of the function. The idea is that the two operations should commute, whether we first take the gradient, which is a derivative, and then take the Lie derivative, which is a derivative, or first take the Lie derivative and then the gradient, that should be the same. So we require that to be commutative. So we want our Lie derivative to map one forms into one forms in such a way that the df, the directional derivative in the direction of xi of df, so the directional derivative of the gradient we define to be the gradient of the directional derivative. Okay? So here's f. Xi of f is the directional derivative of f, and then which is a function, and then we take the gradient of it. That's this expression here. And we already know how to do that. All the ingredients we know of. How to evaluate a tangent vector on a function, we can do that. And then we have a function, we can apply the directional, the exterior derivative on that. We get a one form, we know how to do this. So the definition is that the Lie derivation on the gradient is the gradient of the Lie derivative, because the directional derivative on functions is the Lie derivative on functions. Okay, so to summarize, we defined the Lie derivative to have two properties. First, on functions, it's the ordinary directional derivative. Second, on one forms, it commutes with the property of taking the gradient. So we say that the Lie derivative of a gradient is the gradient of the Lie derivative. And since we can always form a basis with gradient fields, this will define, I mean, for example, the dxi. This defines the Lie derivative on a basis of one form. So now we've defined the Lie derivative everywhere. But remember, we didn't actually use the inner derivation for this. We defined the Lie derivative by its properties of being the ordinary directional derivative on functions, and in, on one forms, it should commute with the gradient operation, so with a d. But the inner derivation didn't come in. We defined it in this way inductively. We said how it acts on one forms and zero forms, and therefore you can get it on R forms, knowing that it's going to be a derivation of degree zero. But there's also a direct way of writing down what the Lie derivation is, namely that. So it turns out that the Lie derivative in the direction of psi of any differential form can be expressed this way. The d will raise the degree by one, the interior derivative will lower it, so in total you leave this, you get the same degree, and that one does the same. Let's look at how this is proven. In order to prove this, we only need to prove that it is true on zero forms and the basis of one form, because that defines a derivation everywhere. So let's check it on zero forms. We take the Lie derivative and apply it to a zero form, a function. Then what does it do? Well, by definition, the way we defined it above, the Lie derivative on functions gives us the evaluation of the tangent vector on a function. It's this, right? But the claim of Cartan is that you can actually calculate it this way too. So let's see. According to Cartan, we have that the Lie derivation of a function is d after I plus I after d of f. Now let's see. Here we have the inner derivation acting on a function f. Now remember, when we defined the inner derivation, we defined its action on zero forms, its action on one forms. That defined it everywhere. The action of the inner derivation on zero forms was zero, right? Remember, the inner derivation mapped all functions to zero. Good to know, because that means that is zero. The whole thing here is zero, because we are acting on a zero form. But the other term is not. Here we have the gradient of f and then the inner derivation of it. So that is a one form, and we need to calculate the inner derivation of it. How did that work? How did the inner derivation act on one forms? Well, by plugging the vector into that one form. Right? That was the inner product between tangent and cotangent vectors, the evaluation of them against each other. And so that's, of course, the df, the cotangent vector df, applied to the tangent vector xi. But what is that? The df applied to xi is the xi applied to f. So it's xi applied to f, and that matches. Okay, now let's check that Cartan got it right regarding the action of the Lie derivation on one forms. Okay, so what does it do? It acts on a one form df in this way. According to Cartan, di plus id. Now we see that on the right hand side here we have d after d. Right? One of the d's is from this, and one of the d's is from that, because we choose to have it act on gradient, on gradients. You can always choose a basis among the gradient fields, such as the dxi. So this is now vanishing, but that one is contributing. So what is the inner derivation then of df? Well, we just discussed that. That is just xi on f. And then we end up with d on xi of f. D of xi on f. But that is what we had defined with the previous method too. The only thing that remains to be checked now is that this is actually a derivation of degree k equals 0, so that we can build it all up from, as we showed, 0 forms and 1 forms, that it's true for all forms, because it propagates because these guys are obeying the Leibniz rule. I leave it up to you to check that the Leibniz rule is obeyed. It's actually kind of fun to try that out with this. It's purely algebraic. Now, let's define the commutator. You know the quantum commutator from quantum mechanics, but of course the commutator can be defined for anything, in particular maps. So if we have a map from the Grassmann algebra into the Grassmann algebra and another one, then we can consider the commutator of these two maps. So the little circle stands for concatenation again. We have several of those maps already. We have the exterior derivative, which maps differential forms into differential forms, and the inner derivation that maps differential forms into differential forms, and now the Lie derivative, which does that too. So we can now, we have a whole algebra of these maps, right? We can apply D and then I and then L xi and then I and then D again, or whichever sequence we want. So in particular, we can look at the commutator between these guys. One can prove that these commutators are true. The Lie derivation commutes with the exterior derivative. Remember, that was part of the definition. We defined the action of the Lie derivative on one forms by saying that it shouldn't matter whether you first do the Lie derivation and then take the gradient, or first take the gradient and then do the Lie derivative. So for one forms, it was built in. But now we see that that commutativity between taking the directional derivative and taking the exterior derivative actually carries forward to all differential forms. So let's keep that in mind. Lie derivations and exterior derivations commute. However, Lie derivations generally don't commute. It matters in which sequence you do two derivations. And you may wonder, why might that be? Isn't it normally true that if you first differentiate in the x direction and then differentiate in the y direction, both directional derivatives, you get the same as if you first differentiate in the y direction and then differentiate in the x direction? So why is that broken now? Any ideas? Except that, don't have curvature in this. It's just not defined. It's just a manifold. But no metric, no curvature yet. It has no shape. We cannot distinguish whether this thing is flat or curved. It has neither. I see the sentiment, I see the idea, right, the intuition, but it's actually for a different reason. And the reason is this. When we say we differentiate in the x direction, we have in mind that we take our function and differentiate it in the x direction everywhere. Or we say we differentiate in the y direction, and what we generally have in mind without spelling it out, that we differentiate it in the y direction everywhere. But with these vector fields, we have an opportunity to differentiate in the x direction here, but in another place, we differentiate in another direction, in the direction in which we differentiate, I mean, the direction, choice of direction in which we want to differentiate can vary in space. Our vector field can point in many different directions and many different locations. So if we apply a vector field to a function, and the vector field has, you know, it's not just pointing in the same direction everywhere, then we are differentiating at some location, we are differentiating in this direction, another location, we are differentiating in that direction, right? In other words, the direction vectors are themselves space-dependent or space-time-dependent. The tangent vectors fields have a non-trivial space-time dependence. And when you first differentiate in one direction and then differentiate into the other direction, then with the Lie derivative, then the Lie derivative picks up on that. It picks up on how the derivative changed. You see, if I take one point here and I differentiate in this direction, then I'm sort of checking how does the amplitude of the field change as I move from here to there. But now I'm there at the other point, and now I'm differentiating in another direction. But it could be that the vector field that determines the second direction had a different value here than over there. The choice of in which direction I want to differentiate may have changed from here to there. There's a rate of change of the vector fields, and that's being picked up here. And you see that here, the commutator of two vector fields is the commutator of the Lie derivative in two directions is the Lie derivative of the commutator of the two vector fields. Basically, this is picking up how much the vector field Xi2 is changing in the Xi1 direction at every location, or how much the Xi1 vector field is changing in the Xi2 direction. If, for example, you choose the Xi1 to be the vector field d by dx1, so you're always differentiating in the x1 direction, and you choose the vector field Xi2 to be d by dx2, so you're always differentiating in the two direction, well, then the two guys will commute. This is zero, and yes, you have that the Lie derivatives commute. It's only because we have, only because in a vector field d by dxi, a vector field will generally have coefficients vi, I equal 1 to n, that depend on x. That's why they don't commute. You just pick up extra factors. You see, if you have another one of those, like here, sum j equal 1 to n, wj of x, dxj, and you apply that on a function f, and you can see how it matters whether you first differentiate this way or that way, because these guys will differentiate those guys. Okay. So here the non-commutativity doesn't arise from curvature. It arises from our choice to have possibly a space dependence in the directions in which we want to differentiate. Yeah, and then the Lie derivative also doesn't commute with the inner derivation, and it also picks something up, but it's a little harder to see why that would be. It's not hard to prove this from the definition of what L is in terms of I and D. Yeah, you see, I wrote it up already that the commutator between vector fields is exactly this. So if I just put this here, okay. So vector fields map functions into functions, and obviously they have a commutator. This is how you calculate it. And that's what we have on the right-hand side here. And it's what is written right here. See, this is the commutator. These are the coefficients of the commutator field, commutator vector field. What's being picked up is this derivative on that, or that derivative on this. Here is what is on the blackboard. And then the terms with the second derivatives are the same in both cases. They drop out. And the only thing that's left over is when these derivatives act on the eta function, and these derivatives act on the xi functions. So that's these things multiplied with the first derivative. And so the commutator is really just coefficient functions. These are the coefficient functions times the first derivatives. So that's the non-trivial part of this calculation. It's kind of clear that they don't commute, but that the commutator is itself a vector field, that's non-trivial. It is because the second derivative terms in this, see when you apply xi and then eta, you get the second derivative. But the second derivative terms are the same whether you calculate them this way round or that way round. Because the second derivative terms don't involve a derivative acting on the coefficient functions. No, the second derivative terms are the ones where each of the derivatives act on the function f. And so that's commutative, they go away. And we're just left with extra terms that come from differentiating the eta and the xi functions. And that just multiplies one leftover derivative. So the commutator of a vector field, of two vector fields, is a vector field. This leads to some questions. Since the Lie derivative is the directional derivative on differential forms, we can only, so far, differentiate directionally vector differential forms. How do we directionally differentiate tensor fields? Can we do that? We can do that, but we have to start from scratch. The reason is that our definition so far has relied on being able to define the Lie derivative as a derivation on the Grassmann algebra. But the Grassmann algebra is defined only for differential forms, not for arbitrary tensors, defined only for totally antisymmetric covariant tensors and their linear combinations. So there is another way, and it's instructive to see the other way, to define Lie derivatives. The Lie derivative can also be defined based on the ideas of Newton and Leibniz as a limit. Epsilon going to zero, f of x plus epsilon minus f of x divided by epsilon. Of course, we'll have to clarify a few things here, especially what is that? F of x plus epsilon, when what we're dealing with is not a function on the real line, but it's a function on the manifold. So for that purpose, we now do the geometric definition of the Lie derivative. Let's start by reconsidering the geometric definition of a tangent vector. Remember that for any path in the manifold, so any map from an interval in R, the parameter space of our path, into the manifold, the parameter of the path may be called T. So our path is a map from T, a parameter, which you can think of as the time, into the manifold. So gamma of T is a point of the manifold. So for any path like that, we have a tangent vector that we called gamma bar at the point t0, which is an element of the tangent space of the point gamma of t0. So the path is called gamma of t, and when t reaches the value t0, that's the point p we are interested in, and we are interested in the tangent vector to that point that is defined by that path, which intuitively, of course, is going to be the velocity that this path has at that point, gamma of T naught. So for any path, we have a tangent vector. And how is the tangent vector defined? Well, a tangent vector is supposed to feed on functions and give us a number. Tangent vector at that point feeds on functions, gives us a number. But what number is that to be? Well, if you remember, you take the path, and then on the path, along the path, you evaluate the function f, and then calculate the derivative with respect to the path parameter at time t equals zero. Remember that was this example where we said, imagine you have a path on the manifold and the function f is like the temperature function on the manifold, and then d by dt of f is the rate of change of the temperature as you go through the point gamma of T naught. So for every path, we had a method for getting a number out of a function. Namely, you take the function, evaluate it along the path, and calculate the rate of change with respect to the path parameter at that point. So then we had to prove that this obeys the property of obeying the Leibniz rule, is linear, and so on. And so we identified this as being a tangent vector. Now imagine that we are given a vector field psi, which of course is going to be the vector field along which we want to do the Lie derivative. Imagine we are given a vector field psi, then a path gamma is called an integral curve of the vector field psi if the vector field evaluated on the path is the tangent vector of that path. So you have a vector field which you may visualize as having a tangent vector assigned to every point. Now imagine you draw a curve such that the curve is tangent to all of the vectors of the vector field that it passes by. So given a vector field, you can take a starting point, and then you try to write down a path whose tangent is the vector field, is given by the vector field at every point. So you're given kind of a velocity field, and then you ask which path has as its velocities the values of this velocity field. These are the integral curves of a vector field. And you don't always have integral curves globally. But from the theory of ordinary differential equations, one can prove that, we are assuming a smoothness of the tangent vector field here. But one can then prove that for every point in the manifold, there exists some neighborhood, there exists a maximal integral curve always through that point. So you choose a vector field, you choose a point, and then there's going to be an integral curve through that point. And you can try to extend it as far as possible, but sometimes it's not further extendable. But there's always going to be a finite range that you can do that. And that means that a vector field gives us a flow. So you choose a vector field, and then every point of the manifold can be asked to flow along its integral curve. What we then obtain is that if we run the integral flow for a certain finite amount of the parameter of the integral curves, let's say 1 second or 1 unit of time or whatever, just to have an intuitive picture of it, then every point of the manifold goes into another point. Like this would be, let's say this is a point of the manifold, and that is the integral curve to the vector field. I didn't draw the tangent vector field here. But given the tangent vector field, this could be an integral curve. It's a curve that is tangent to the vector field at every point, and this one as well, and so on. So what I drew here are integral curves for that vector field. And then if we follow that integral curve until the parameter reaches the value 1, well, then this point gets mapped into this one. That one gets mapped into this one. Each point gets mapped a little bit down the road along its integral curve. And now we arrive at a structure that we've had before. We are mapping here the manifold into itself. You see, each point gets mapped into a different point. We can view this as a map of the manifold into itself, or as a map of a of the manifold into a copy of itself. So what we have is that the flow according to the vector field is mapping the points of the manifold into points of the manifold. So I just drew the manifold twice. Now remember that we've had maps between manifolds many times, and we studied how a diffeomorphism from a manifold into a manifold induces pullbacks. It induces maps from the tangent space here to the tangent space there. And the space of function germs into the space of function germs, and generally from tensors into tensors. If this is a differentiable invertible map, then we have correspondingly nicely behaved pullback maps between all the structures that we can build on that. And here we simply have the same manifold twice, but it's the same mathematics. So the flow that we had, and the flow that we had is mapping the manifold into itself, and that induces, as I said, all those pullback maps. But keep in mind that you shouldn't think of the flow now as something continuous. Instead, we chose a particular point in time. So we just let all the points flow for amount of time along the integral curves, and then we take a snapshot. Okay, so it's not something continuous anymore. We use that to generate a diffeomorphism, but we simply have a map from the manifold into the manifold, completely static thing. There's nothing flowing anymore. The flow was only used to generate, to find out what the points would be mapped into after, let's say, a second. So we have a static map from the manifold into itself, and that induces all sorts of things, like the function germs get mapped into each other, and the tangent spaces have an isomorphism, and so on, cotangent spaces and all tensor spaces. So if P is a point in the manifold, and this is the space of RS tensors, R-fold contravariant and S-fold covariant tensors, then we have a pullback map which maps this space of tensors on P to the space of RS tensors at the point which is the image under the flow after a second or so. So phi T of P. So T is the amount of time that we allowed this to flow. So we have an isomorphism here between those two, because the diffeomorphism between the manifold and itself is assumed to be differentiable and invertible. We don't carry the flow too far. It should still be well defined. So this means that in particular, a tensor in here gets mapped into a tensor in there. And a tensor field tau does what? At every point in the manifold, it gives us an element in that tensor space. So now we can define what we mean by a tensor field being invariant under the flow. We can look at a tensor, tau, and we can use the pullback to map that tensor or the tensor field to the other place in the manifold. So our diffeomorphism, our flow, maps all points of the manifold into other points of the manifold. It maps function germs into function germs, maps tangent to cotangent vectors, etc. And in particular, it maps arbitrary tensor fields into their displaced versions elsewhere. So in particular, you could take a tensor field that's defined everywhere, and then you can ask, I look at the tensor field here, I look at the tensor field there. And then I use the flow to map the tensor field from here into there. And then I compare with what the tensor field anyway did there, the original one, not mapped one. And if it's the same, if under the flow the tensor field doesn't change, then we say that the tensor field is invariant under the flow. You see, we need that ultimately because we are after a Newton-Leibniz kind of rule where we have f of x plus epsilon minus f of x divided by epsilon, limit epsilon going to zero is the derivative. But here on the manifold, we first have to clarify what that is. You see, if F is a tensor field, then F of x plus epsilon, where this is a point on the manifold, is a tensor living in a tensor space at a point that's different from that point. And we cannot compare two vectors that live in different vector spaces. We cannot compare two tensors that live in two different tensor spaces. They have to be in the same tensor space. And that's what this pullback does. It allows us to take a tensor from one point of the manifold, map it bijectively into a tensor at another point of that manifold, namely the point where the flow leads into, and then we can compare that with the tensor that was there all along before we did the flow. The tensor field took some value there, right? And these two are now comparable. The image of this over here is comparable because it lives in the same tangent tensor space as the tensor field that was there before we applied the flow. Right, so in particular, a special case is where the tensor field does not change. We say that the tensor field tau is invariant under the flow induced by the vector field psi if, when I take a point of the manifold and then look at the tensor field at that point, at the tensor at that point, and then do the pullback under the flow, then I get a tensor at a different point, namely the point where we flow to, then this should be the same as if we first mapped the point into some other point according to the flow, and then evaluate the tensor field there. If these two happen to be the same, and there's a priori no reason for them to be the same, but if they happen to be the same, then we say that the vector field is invariant under that flow, at least under that discrete flow. But you can require it even for all values of t, then it's invariant under the continuous flow. So this is the image of the tensor field's value at p after the flow, and this is the tensor field's value at the tensor field's value at the image of p. So do you first evaluate what the tensor field says and then map that according to the flow, or you first go with the flow and then evaluate what the tensor field says? And if they are the same, then you say that the tensor field is invariant under the flow. In this case, you would say that it doesn't change, the Lie derivative of it would vanish. It's like constant. Okay, now we are ready to do the Newton-Leibniz thing for tensor fields. The definition is that the Lie derivative, according to the geometric definition, of any tensor field tau at some point p, which is the origin of one of those integral curves along the vector field psi, is defined in this way. The Lie derivative of the tensor field in the direction of psi is given by taking the tensor field and comparing it with the tensor field you obtain by applying the pullback. It's actually the inverse pullback because you're kind of comparing it. You have to pull this one into that space, into the tensor space of that one. For numbers, not a problem, but for tensors, we have to do that. So we are evolving according to the flow tau and subtracting what we get from what is there. So we are comparing the tensor field that you get by mapping according to the flow to the tensor field that's there anyway, taking the difference between the two, dividing by t in the same way that Newton and Leibniz divided by epsilon, and then take the limit for t going to zero. See, in some ways, the algebraic definitions are easier, right, than the geometric ones. So explicitly in a chart, if phi is mapping x into x tilde with an infinitesimal flow that x tilde is xi plus t times xi I of x plus higher order. So imagine that we are considering the flow along the integral curves, but for the purposes of this and our definition up there, we only need the infinitesimal start of that flow. Because, you know, we take the limit, epsilon going to zero. So we just need to know the start of that flow. So in particular, points x are mapped into points x tilde, but just with the first order difference. So the x tilde, the points x tilde are xi plus, and then t is very small. In fact, t will go to zero later on. That's the epsilon in this case, times some velocity vector that tells us how fast that flow is. And that's, of course, the tangent vector field. So an infinitesimal integral flow will be simply given by taking the coordinates and adding to it the vector field. A finite integral flow is, of course, much more complicated. But it is generated by the vector field, and therefore the infinitesimal vector flow can, infinitesimal integral flow is taking simply this form. And we can calculate what the Jacobian matrix is of that change of coordinate functions here. And the Jacobian matrix is simply differentiating the x tildes by with respect to the x. So the x tilde differentiated with respect to the x just gives us a Kronecker delta plus, and then we have here the derivative of the vector field with respect to the x. We can also calculate the inverse Jacobian, and that just gives us a minus sign over here. You see why that is? Whenever you have something Taylor expanded like this, and you want the inverse, you just change this, the minus sign. The reason is that if you multiply this with that, I invite you to do it explicitly, but you can already see how that works. If you multiply this with that, then these are just identities that multiply to the identity. And the mixed terms, this times that and this times that, come with opposite signs. So they cancel each other out. And these two terms also get multiplied, but they are t squared. So they're already higher order, so to first order they don't matter. And that's why that is to first order the inverse of that. So then the image of a tensor at the point x tilde under the flow backwards from x tilde to x has these components. So that's the image of the tensor. And then we have the tensor components and the various Jacobian factors. And remember that depending on whether they're contravariant or covariant, they have the corresponding behavior here. And we wrote down what these Jacobian terms are as identity plus or minus these derivatives of the tangent vector fields. And so we just write that out. This thing we write as a 1 minus this, because it's the covariant case, and the contravariant case is then this one. Sorry, these are all the minus factors, and here are all the plus factors from these and from those. And we only keep the terms to first order. So all the higher powers of t go away. Also, the tensor itself, the coefficient matrix itself changes over time. So we have here that x tilde is x plus t xi, and we therefore do a Taylor expansion of this coefficient matrix as well. And that gives us then this. We obtain the original tensor And then we obtain the Taylor expansion of the coefficient matrix, so comma k, derivative with respect to k, and multiplied with the xi k, that's this expansion up here, using the fact that this needs to be Taylor expanded. So we differentiate that with respect to the direction k, and then xi k, that's this term here, and then all the other terms will be terms to first order arising from all those powers here. And that gives us then these terms here. They're all the terms that are linear in T. Therefore now, using the Newton-Leibniz definition of what the Lie derivative is, we obtain that the Lie derivative is the limit of this shifted tensor. Remember, there were two reasons for why this is non-trivial. One of the reasons is that the matrix of the coefficient matrix is changing over time. That's this derivative, that the coefficient matrix has, the coefficient matrix has a position dependence, but also the vector fields have position dependence. So there are two reasons for non-triviality in the Lie derivative. Vector fields, position dependence, and the tensor that we differentiate has a matrix which is also position dependent. You can't strictly separate these two things, because if you change coordinate system, then what looked like a space dependence of the vector field may no longer be a space dependence of the vector field. Now it becomes a space dependence of the coefficient matrix of the tensor. So these two things are intricately linked. Anyway, if we collect everything together, we obtain here this rather lengthy formula for the Lie derivative of a tensor field, where again we see the two kinds of terms, the derivative of the coefficient matrix multiplied with the vector field, but also the coefficient matrix just carried forward, but multiplied with derivatives of the direction vector field. So in particular, if your direction vector field in which you want to differentiate is simply the x1 direction, well, then you can forget about all those terms over here, right? Because if in your coordinate system, you'd simply say, I want to do the Lie derivative in the x1 direction. Well, xi is then simply the vector which is d by dx1. And so its space derivatives all vanish. And then the only derivative that matters is this derivative here. Xi, right? And so it's literally just the directional derivative in x1 direction. So why did we go through all of this trouble? Well, it's because we want a Lie derivative that's independent of any choice of coordinate system. And if we choose a different coordinate system, same Lie derivative, same vector field, same xi, same tensor tau, and we do this in a different coordinate system, well, in a different coordinate system, our vector field xi, which in the old coordinate system was simply differentiated in the x1 direction always, in the new coordinate system, it would be a very complicated vector field with space-dependent coefficients. And then in order to still get the same thing, you have to take into account all of this. So the whole point of this exercise is to do operations that are abstractly defined and not tied to any particular choice of coordinate system. Right, so here we show that the action of, you're almost out of time, the action of the Lie derivative on tensors that we just defined is equivalent or agrees with the algebraic definition of the Lie derivative that we had earlier, if we apply both of them to differential forms. So for that, we just have to show that on lambda 0 and lambda 1, they are the same. And we can show that. But let's just, because we're a little bit out of time, let's just move on. Here are collected properties. So now we have a definition of the Lie derivative, which is mapping Rs tensors into Rs tensors. And in particular, we can now calculate what the leading derivative is of vector a vector field. Before, we could only calculate the leading derivative of one forms if we wanted a vector field. It was a covector field. Right? One forms are cotangent vector fields. And because one forms are differential forms, with the algebraic definition of the leading derivative, we were able to calculate what its leading derivative is. But previously, we were not able to apply the leading derivative to contravariant tensors. Now, we can do that, and we can calculate what the leading derivative is of a tangent vector, not a cotangent vector. And what is it then? It turns out, you have to plug it in, it turns out that the leading derivative of a tangent vector is the commutator. The leading derivative in the xi direction of a tangent vector field eta is the commutator between the two. It's not hard to see if you just go back to this formula. It tells us what the leading derivative is of anything, any RS tensor. And now you can just leave it up to you to figure it out. Imagine you choose here for the tau the just a tangent vector field. All right? So the leading derivative of a tangent vector field is the commutator of the direction in which we want to differentiate and the tangent vector field. The leading derivative is having also this property. If you take the leading derivative into the direction of xi plus eta, it is actually the leading derivative in the direction of xi plus the leading derivative in the direction of eta, which is perhaps a little surprising, but yes, that's what you get. If you take the leading derivative in the direction of the commutator of two vector fields, you get the commutator of the leading directions. So taking the commutator and taking the leading derivative actually commutes, where this is defined as, you know, do the leading derivative in the xi direction, then in the eta direction, minus the other way around. Well, then we can ask, does this definition of the leading derivative still obey a kind of Leibniz rule? And it kind of does. If you apply the leading derivative defined with the Newton-Leibniz idea of taking limits to the tensor product of two tensors, so not the wedge product, but the tensor product, and they can be arbitrary tensors, then yes, you still have a Leibniz rule for those. But remember that these tensors form, while there's a product in that, and they form an algebra, it's a very different algebra from the Grassmann algebra. And for the purposes of integration and many other things in general relativity and differential geometry, the Grassmann algebra is more important than the tensor algebra that you get in this way. Okay, that's all for today. See you on Tuesday. Oh, I do have questions. I do have time for questions. Yes.
The definition of leading derivative.
Yes.
Using the flow, right? Instead of using the inverse map, I could just use push forward. Wouldn't that work? Because what you are doing is you do a callback along t, and then you do the inverse.
Yes. Map. Yes. In fact, you could. Yes. You could also do it.
We just push it forward and come.
Yes. Yeah. You could. I mean, it ultimately, because you take the coincidence limit, you could compare the tensors at the location that you start with, or you could compare the tensors at the location that you flow to. Since both locations in the limit become the same location, you could do that. So you could either map from here to there or from there to here. In this case, it would be a trivial thing because there's no difference. But in the case of tensors, there is a difference, but you get the same result.
And another question is, should we think of Lie derivative as some kind of, like, I don't know, the fluid dynamics kind of like material derivative thing?
To some extent you can, but you have to be careful because fluids can have very different properties. There are many different kinds of fluids. But in principle, yes, you can intuitively think of the integral flow to a tensor, to a vector field, as being particles that flow along the manifold and whose tangent vectors happen to match the vectors of the tangent vector field. It's just that it's not trivial to find a dynamical equation for a fluid such that a fluid would actually behave this way. For example, you can write down a vector field in which the vectors tend to point outwards in all directions. That requires you for your fluid to have an explosion. So if you had, for example, an incompressible fluid, it couldn't possibly have the integral curves for that vector field. Or let's put it this way, not for every vector field is there an equation of motion for a fluid such that the motion of the fluid could be one of those integral curves. Yeah. Well, given the equations of motion of a fluid, it would be very nice if you could calculate what the integral curves then are. Yeah. But it's not automatic. We're not getting fluid mechanics for free.
So we get two definitions of the algebra, not the algebra, the derivative. The first one is algebraic, and the second one is geometric. And from my point of view, the second one is more general than the first one, because the second one applies on the tensors, the first one only on forms. So do we have a more general definition of the derivative on the in the algebraic manner? Like more general algebra.
Kind of, yes, yes. You could also define it this way.
This way?
Yeah.
You say that.
But you see, if you define it this way on the algebra of tensor fields where the addition is given just by summing tensors and the multiplication is tensor multiplication, you could define the Lie derivative as being a derivation on that algebra. You could do that, but one of the points of doing it in a geometric way, see, I'm not saying that you had to do it a geometric way. One of the points of doing it the geometric way is that you then get an idea of what the Lie derivative actually achieves. Namely that it considers, it allows you to calculate the change of a field under a flow. And a very important concept here is the concept of identifying a tensor here with a tensor over there. Because in principle, they live in different spaces, right? So every point has its tangent space and its cotangent space and its tensor space. And it has elements in there. And another point has a different tangent, cotangent, and tensor space, which has elements in there. And you cannot add them or subtract them when they're in different spaces. Because there will be a basis here, a basis there, but they just have nothing to do with each other. You can't compare them. So, but in order to be able to do this, like take the difference between a tensor here and a tensor there, they have to live in the same space, in the same tensor space to be able to be subtracted from each other. So you need a map, an isomorphism that maps the tensor space here into the tensor space over there. And there are different ways to do this. And later we will find one way to do that, which is by parallel transport, which is encoding the notion of curvature and encoding the notion of shape of a manifold. So that's one way to associate, to map the tensor space here to a tensor space over there so that you can then define the derivatives. And that will give us the covariant derivative later on. But here we don't have curvature or parallel transport or metrics or anything of this kind just yet. So we had to find another way of making a tensor here comparable or subtractable from a tensor over there. And for that purpose, we said, OK, we have a map that maps this point here to the point over there, maps all points of the manifold into other points. So all those points that need to be compared with each other are mapped into each other. And then we said, what do we have? Under this flow, we end up with a map from the manifold into the manifold. And like the manifold now, and then the manifold a second later for value t equal 1 or something. And then we have that all functions on the manifold get mapped into functions on the manifold. or function germs, right? Points to points, function germs to function germs. And that induces by pullback, you know, how tangent vector spaces can be identified, cotangent spaces, vector spaces can be identified, and so on. And then we had an identification of the tensor spaces here and there. We were able to subtract them from each other, get a difference vector. And then we said, okay, we don't want to evolve it for t equal 1. We let t go to 0. And then we obtained that definition from there. And so the key here is that we don't need any curvature or parallel transport or anything of that kind for this. The way that the identification is done is completely reliant on how this diffeomorphism looks like. How do we map the manifold here to the manifold over there? So you can think of, for example, a coordinate system and a manifold initially. These are just functions, right? The coordinate functions, x1, x2, x3, x4, they're just functions. You can think of the manifold as being crisscrossed with a kind of chessboard pattern of rectangular lines. They're not really rectangular on the manifold, right? But you have some coordinate system printed on your manifold. And then after the flow, you have an image of that coordinate system, but it's distorted, right? But you can still track what belongs to what. And that's how you can still track how tangent vector gets mapped into tangent vector, cotangent vector into cotangent vector, and so on. And that makes these things comparable, and then you can subtract them from each other. So the canonical isomorphism between the tensor spaces at two points, the cotangent spaces, the tensor spaces, are entirely induced by the diffeomorphism that we choose. It's very important. The isomorphism is induced by the xi, by the vector field that induces the flow. The isomorphism is not a property of the manifold. It's a property of our choice of xi. Later on, when we do parallel transport on a curved manifold, the isomorphism between neighboring tangent spaces or cotangent spaces or tensor spaces, that isomorphism will be established by parallel transporting vectors or tensors. And that will be tied to the manifold itself. There's no choice on our part, right? We simply have that the manifold itself, it identifies parallel transport, and then there is nothing further to be chosen. And that tells you how every vector gets parallel transported to any other vector. So that's important to keep apart, because we will end up with two kinds of directional derivatives. The Lie derivative, which knows nothing about curvature, metrics, or anything, or parallel transport, where the identification of the points, and therefore the whole business of differentiation, is tied to the xi, because the xi gives us the flow, and that by pullback gives us the identification of the tensor spaces. And then later, we have the directional derivative by parallel transport. And that's also directional derivative, but the parallel transport will be determined not just by the direction you choose, not just by the xi, but it will be determined by the metric, the curvature, the affine connection. Yes, that's right. And there will be an interesting interplay between those Lie derivatives and the covariant derivatives. So basically, these are derivatives under diffeomorphism. You choose an arbitrary diffeomorphism. We had it generated by a vector field. But in principle, just choose any arbitrary diffeomorphism. You just have to make it, you have to have it parameterized so that when the parameter goes to 0, the diffeomorphism becomes the identity. It's like a flow that you can make bigger or smaller. So for any arbitrary diffeomorphism, you can calculate how your tensors behave under that flow of that diffeomorphism. In particular, you can calculate how a tensor changes under change of coordinates. Right? Because that would be another flow. And that's how you would view it. Yeah. I mean, a change of coordinates is a diffeomorphism. Any further questions? All right. Have a nice weekend.
What's the name of this algebra?
I don't think it has a fancy name, it's just tensor algebra. And you know, it's kind of fundamental because these guys are called tensor products because it's a tensor product of tensors, right? Yeah, it's just tensor algebra.